Hi, welcome to Not Another Marketing Podcast, where I'm talking to Andrew Halley, the CMO at Bynder, which is a digital asset management platform. And we're talking about personalized marketing. And are things getting a little bit creepy? Thanks for listening. It's a great chat with Andrew with lots of insight on marketing personalization and that bag or that pair of shoes that follows you everywhere around the internet. It's everywhere. Just because you clicked on it once. We'll talk about that bag or that shirt. We talk about it. Andrew is the Chief Marketing Officer at Bynder.com, which is B-Y-N-D-E-R.com. It's a digital asset management platform, which basically it means that it enables marketing teams to collaborate in the cloud and find and store all their important digital assets. To head over and have a look at Bynder, it's B-Y-N-D-E-R.com. One thing I want to quickly mention before we start is that Not Another Marketing Podcast is totally ad-free, and I'd love it if you could give the pod a quick shout on social media or subscribe via your podcast app. You can check out all the links and more podcasts at jtid.co.uk/podcasts. Right, let's get on with it. So the first thing I asked Andrew was to explain what marketing personalization is.
Well, like many parts of the of MarTech, right, we've created a bit of a monster with a term here, and I think it can refer to a couple of things. I think a lot of times people say personalization interchangeably with what might be better called micro-segmentation, right? I mean, personalization probably means literally one-to-one. Like I have one thing to say to one individual. But I think in practice, it's more likely we mean saying specific things to very small targeted segments so that it feels very personal, even if it's not quite one-to-one marketing.
It's a bit more than just saying, hi, Dave, in an email, isn't it?
Well, you know, when you look at surveys, and I recently looked at Evergage does a yearly kind of report of personalization. And funny you should mention that, John. You know, email personalization is the number one most personalized channel. It probably is the easiest one to do. And that's relatively low-hanging fruit, but certainly it goes far, can go far beyond that.
I think when you talk about email marketing personalization, particularly with names and things, I'm not a big fan myself of saying hi and then first name, because you're always relying on the person at the other end to actually put their name in properly.
You're right. And I think I'm sure we all speaking and listening here to the podcast have had experience of that going wrong. Or if it's blank, you get that funny little, you know, hi, you know, symbols, right? Yeah. Where the email system's trying to insert something, but there's nothing there. Yeah. I think that's one of the practical downsides of personalization. When it works well, but it's difficult. And you've just described, you know, what one of the ways it can go wrong.
So give me a couple of examples of how marketers personalize content.
So I think an easy one is just to think of a lot of times when people show ads on social media. I know in some of the other podcasts of yours that I've listened to, you know, doing Facebook ads, for example, simply showing imagery of people that you think reflect the people that you're advertising to. And an easy example would just be showing a family versus showing an individual, or showing someone of an age category, right, that you think that they might be in is something that you see pretty frequently. And I know I see that in ads that I'm shown. I think another really good one is location. You may see, so for example, we have a customer who makes video ads that are more localized, and the only thing they're doing is really putting in the name of the nearby dealership.
Right.
And so that would be, you know, location would be another easy to kind of personalize element that's not, you know, about me as a person, but it's very relevant to me as a person, since that would be the nearest place for me to go to look at those cars.
It's also purchase history. If we're looking at an online store, things like this, a purchase history, does that work into personalization as well?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that some of the most powerful examples of personalization come from looking at transaction history. It can be as logical, for example, as if one buys a printer, then personalized marketing that promotes the relevant ink cartridges
Sure.
Could be very relevant, especially if timed based on kind of the average length of time that, you know, an ink cartridge lasts. That could be an example of product-based personalization that's very relevant. But those things can be hard to do if you don't have lots of resources.
And a lot of this is about segmenting your data. So we take say the printer cartridge, for example. Everybody who's bought this printer goes into a certain type of segment who get marketed the cartridges. You can end up going down a rabbit hole with segments, though, can't you? And saying somebody who did this, who lives there, who does something else over there, and then it just becomes a mess. When does segmentation stop being useful?
That's a really deep and interesting question, I think. And there's a couple dimensions to it. So one, you know, as you segment further, there is the opportunity to be more relevant. So for example, the right ink cartridge. But as you segment further, costs go up, right? If you're going to deliver content to each of these segments, it just takes more money to have those different pieces of content, right? The audience gets smaller. So you have fewer and fewer people in a segment. Now, if you're speaking to your customers, that's one thing. But specifically, if you're trying to personalize to a prospect audience who aren't your customer yet, you're spending more per segment to reach ever smaller numbers of people. So the economics at some point tip, and it becomes less economic. And I think another thing that's really interesting that's happening, John, is that increasingly the power of the online ad duopoly, Google and Facebook, to what they can do on your behalf without marketers having to get too explicit about their segmentation. They're being able to do more and more and more. For example, you had a great podcast talking about Facebook and the power of the 1% lookalike audiences that they can create.
Yeah.
And in these, Facebook and Google have such great data on the audience, on consumers, and such powerful algorithms, very few organizations can match this. And increasingly, organizations are just better off letting Google and Facebook find the right audience for them and optimize creative and ad placement for them.
Yeah, I think a lot of marketers can sometimes get a little bit too clever with it, can't they? And they can think to themselves, well, we'll segment by this, by this, by this, by this, by this. And then you end up with such a small audience to actually that it's you've actually wasted your time.
You're exactly right, I think. You know, it seems far better to find the couple things that really matter and pay attention to get the data right, to test it, and to get the creative right. I think, you know, we've been in the last 20 years or so, once marketing became digital, we as marketers were so glad to finally have data and be able to solve that old conundrum of perhaps you know that old saying of, I know half my marketing is wasted, I just don't know which half.
Yeah.
You know, that's not true anymore. But I think at some degree, we as marketers, and I certainly would include myself amongst them, have become bedazzled by data and by the ability to finally see what works and really investing so much into performance marketing. And I think at times that's taken away important emphasis on storytelling, on creative, on content. And I think what's one interesting thing I think we're starting to see is that you know, we're starting to reach kind of the high watermark of personalization and realize that maybe some we'd have better return on effort and looking at that creative dimension to marketing and telling our story. So I think we've kind of, it's been a great time, but we're reaching kind of the limits. And I love seeing these emerging focus on storytelling.
So you think it's a good idea to be testing creative all the time, be running multiple ads, for example, and testing which type of creative works best?
I think that's where these two kind of come together, right, which is really great. So it's not just about, you know, the targeting and the audience finding. It's an important part of data-driven marketing and critical important. We'll never go away from that, but using the access to data we have to help us make better decisions on creative, which in many circumstances really, you know, quality of creative is the number one determinant of action on advertising and offers. So let me give an example. Let's say that we're we offer footwear, and we see someone looking at a certain athletic shoe, and we kind of file away and then start really following that person around the internet, right? Trying to get them to actually come back and buy that exact athletic shoe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? That's kind of a very product-oriented way to use the insight. But perhaps there's more and more valuable insight in realizing that, huh, this customer of mine picked an athletic shoe. And that says something about them as a consumer, that they're, you know, they're interested in sport, perhaps even a particular sport. And maybe that actually is more useful for the types of creative I would show them. Show ads that involve sport and show an active sort of lifestyle style. So there's an example, I think, of kind of just how the data that we have can help inform, you know, creative decisions. Also, there is creative testing, as you mentioned, which ones work best. I think one thing that's held that back, John, is whereas for 20 years, marketing technology has really made huge strides, you know, for targeting, not as much has happened on the creative side. And as we spoke earlier, as you segment down, you know, you need more creative to meet the needs of these different segments and to do testing. And another more recent interesting trend is that marketing technology is starting to address that need and bring the sorts of productivity and efficiency improvements to the creative side of the house that the execution side of the house has already seen. So I think that's a promising trend. You know, if we want to test different creatives, you know, maybe we don't need to go back and create from scratch an alternative creative. Do we just need to change maybe 5 or 10% of things? Change some colors, change some fonts. There's certain things that we can test that are more subject to automation than requiring, again, one of our precious creative resources to kind of go back and create a testing variant.
So when do you think personalized content starts to get a little bit creepy? And do you think folks are getting a bit tired of it now?
I think definitely. You know, just the fact that we now have concepts, the public discourse about it, like have you heard the term surveillance marketing?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and surveillance capitalism. So there's, you know, there's even kind of a label for this. For me, my particular bugaboo has been the zombie product ad. Have you had one of these where it's the ad that follows you on the internet and it just won't die?
Yeah. Yeah, I got some boots at the moment, some running boots at the moment, running shoes at the moment that you're following me around everywhere.
Yeah, for me, it's a Hawaiian shirt. I bought a Hawaiian shirt 3 years ago for a midwinter party, and still I get bombarded by these ads. So there's the zombie product. I think another, because it's creepy and annoying, right? I think another one is the case of mistaken identity, right? My wife has a sore foot, but now I'm getting all these ads for compression socks. So yeah, I think there's a number of you know, creepy and annoying things that are happening. And I think that this is leading to consumer pushback, and consumers have taken this to government. And we now have this, I think, frustration and pushback expressed in a regulatory way, right? And you've got where you are, the GDPR was kind of groundbreaking in this respect. And now here in the States, we've got the CCPA out of California, you know, where this we're starting to see not just kind of consumer backlash, but that expressed in a regulatory way as well.
Do you think marketers sort of jump on really clever tactics a little bit too quickly and forget that the first rule of marketing is to listen to what your customer wants?
I think that's true. I know as a marketing leader, you know, constantly feel a pressure to kind of know the latest and the greatest thing. I don't know how much that's, you know, speaks to marketers always looking for an edge. Yeah, I definitely think, and you know, I think it's also kind of partly, you know, technology vendors are always trying to kind of have the latest, greatest thing, in that we wouldn't want to deny that just great advances have been made in marketing technology that do let us do orders of magnitude better job than we used to be able to do. But yeah, I think there is a little bit of, you know, pressure to kind of jump on that newest, greatest thing, like video ads on TikTok. I don't know if you've have you done a segment on that yet, John?
Not yet. No. That's probably about 30 years younger than I am.
Your kids will drag you into it, I promise.
I'm sure they will. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, do you think that with the cleverness of the technology, if our audience is saying we don't want this creepy stuff going on, do you think marketers maybe in the future will need to pull back from this?
Yes, absolutely. I know that many do. I'll give one example from a company that I've spent a long time working in the marketing technology realm, and we had one product that would allow, for example, would monitor bank deposits. And, you know, it's very interesting to a bank if you drop 30,000 pounds into your account when normally you're making biweekly deposits of 1 or 2,000. You know, that anomalous large deposit is very interesting. A bank wants to hold on to that, get it into a savings product, or maybe that's going to be a down payment for a house and there's an opportunity for a mortgage. So we gave our bank customers this ability, but they very quickly found out that that was about the worst thing that they could do, was immediately call up and say, hey, we noticed you just dropped, 30,000 pounds into your account. What do you want to do with that? Instead, it was best to wait a day or two and then make a general inquiry about just, hey, how is it going, and not even really reference it. More often, that might then come up. And so to be effective often requires not really doing as much as could be done with particular insight, but to kind of match it to, the expectations that I think people have of how they relate to businesses. I think a decent rule of thumb would just be, how would your buyer want to be treated by their local corner store?
So if we don't want to go down the creepy route and we don't want to go down the highly personalized route, is there anything else we can do to target more niche groups?
Well, I would just say sometimes you do want to go down that highly personalized route. Again, we mentioned the helpful opportunity to buy the right printer cartridge based on my printer when it's likely to be running low. I mean, done well, good personalized marketing can feel like a service. And I think it just, my feeling is it's just important to not get bedazzled by what we can do, which is call somebody 6 hours after they sold a home, and more think of it empathetically of what would be, helpful to a buyer and in service of a long-term relationship.
So it's more looking at the needs of the customer and also, I suppose, trying to understand when they will start finding things a little bit too creepy.
That's right. I think that's right. And it's so easy to be bedazzled, is the word I used earlier, what can be done. It's amazing what can be done.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I've been to conferences before when we've talked, when there's been marketers just going, oh, I've got to be able to do this, or must be able to do that. Oh, this technology is amazing. We can do this, we can do that. And you think to yourself, well, the end product is going to be the customer at the other side thinking, hang on a little bit, just step back a bit.
That's right. We go to conferences, listen to podcasts, right? And we feel, oh, everybody's doing this. I must be, am I missing out? But I did, before we spoke, I was just doing a little bit of catching up on, what are others saying about this? And I found a couple of interesting things. So, for example, Gartner, very well-known technology analyst firm, put out a prediction late last year. They predict 80% of marketers will abandon personalization efforts by 2025 due to lack of ROI and difficulty with data.
Right.
So I think that's, for a company that's often kind of pushing forward, what's possible with technology, that was a pretty amazing thing to read. They've got a interesting article on a press release about that. And, looking more currently, lots of people are doing it, but many struggle to see the ROI on it. I think, and I just can't help but think it's because they're just trying to do lots rather than finding a couple ways to really speak better to their audience in an empathetic way and doing those well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Do you think the digital marketing world in general is moving away from creativity and focusing a bit too much on just raw data and numbers?
Well, I think that's what has happened, but I think I see that that's kind of reached its high watermark, right? It's never going to go away. It's good, and when personalization done well is good in service of the consumer and can feel like a service. But I feel we're seeing signs of people returning a better balance to also focusing on creative storytelling, the brand, as a differentiator, as personalization, as the low-hanging fruit of saying hello in an email gets done, doing more and more becomes more expensive, and there's relatively better return on, well, let's just make sure we have a good, crisp brand story. So I think there's signs of, at least for those leading edge companies doing it, that the high watermark is in sight. And again, especially as the digital duopoly exerts more control over the value chain, you know, I think we will see a return to creativity and storytelling, which I think will be appreciated by consumers.
Do you think, you mentioned branding, do you think we're trying to humanize our brands a little bit too much? I mean, I know there's always been like the advocacy style brands like Patagonia and North Face, which have been doing it since the 1970s. But every brand now seems to try and make their business sound more human. Do you think people are having a little bit of a fight back at that?
Yes. And I know you've had people more expert than myself on this topic. I find this one of the most interesting topics in marketing right now is the evolution of how we as marketers think about brand in an era of social media and co-ownership of the brand with our customers. I mean, I think that's really a lot of what's driving it, is we as marketers are trying to get our head around the fact that we can't own the brand. We have to relinquish some control to our customers. But how do we do that in the right way? And it can go too far. I don't think the answer to that is at all clear. And definitely there have been missteps, going too far there. I think this is an interesting one that's going to take some time to play out.
Yeah, because it almost appears, I suppose, fake in a way that if a company understands that their clients believe this, this, and this, and then they decide that they're going to believe the same, it's just trying to get money off you.
Yeah, that's right. I think consumers have gotten pretty savvy at sussing out which brands are doing this in merely a performative way.
Yeah.
Right. Especially with a lot of the most recent Black Lives Matter movement and the importance of that to consumers. A lot of brands have been called out for being merely performative on that and not really being authentic. I think, that's the other term that we as marketers are grappling with for our brands, the need for authenticity, right? And authenticity often entails taking a stand. I think a good example would be Nike. And yeah. John, I don't know if you're familiar with, Colin Kaepernick. He's a American football player.
Yeah.
And, I think Nike demonstrated a level of authenticity in some of their dealings with him because it was polarizing. And they took a cost, right? They took a business hit for some of the ways, but they stayed more true. They demonstrated, a commitment to their values, even if maybe there was a short-term financial impact.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if anybody wants to learn how to do that, probably is to look at the history of North Face and Patagonia, particularly Patagonia, because they literally cut their bottom line to shreds because of what they believed in. I think I read somewhere that they went somewhere for some down to fill their jackets, and that was deliberately more expensive than somebody else. And it cost them something like $5 million a year in profits, but they did it because it was more sustainable.
And I bet you it wouldn't be hard for you to guess what kind of a parka, ski parka and ski pants I have in my closet downstairs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's fascinating. I could chat forever with you, Andrew. Thanks for your time. Where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew J. Holly. And you can find me at Binder, BYNDER.com, and on LinkedIn and also listening to your podcast, John.
Fantastic, Andrew. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's been a delight.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it so much that you desperately want to subscribe. You can do that right now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else, your favorite podcast app. You can find all the links, the show notes, and more podcasts at jtid.co.uk/podcasts. Thanks for listening.